It's episode 3 of the Big Car Podcast, and this time I'm talking about a Rover that was actually a success, the Range Rover. The Range Rover and the Rover SD1 were designed by the same people, largely, yet both cars had such different ends. This podcast will be a two-parter with part 2 coming out as the next episode. But in this episode, we'll look at the first generation car that lasted for an amazing 24 years. So, on with the show. If Maria von Trapp had driven a Range Rover, she'd have climbed every mountain, forded every stream, and driven to every Austrian folk festival with the entire von Trapp family singers in the back. Her and the captain would have been able to roll up to the fanciest Salzburg dinner party in their finest glad rags after a day's yodeling sweet nothings to each other on top of a mountain. The Range Rover is the ultimate go-anywhere luxury SUV. It was born out of Rover's desire to sell more cars in the USA, and its design was a complete accident. So how did a company known for saloon cars and agricultural off-roaders invent a car that created a brand new market segment? Well, let's find out. Our story starts with the venerable Land Rover, launched in 1948. It was Rover's answer to the Willys Jeep that was used to great effect by the Americans in World War II. The Land Rover had proven to be a big hit for both civilian and military use, but even as it launched, Rover's management felt it wasn't going to last. The Land Rover was too rough and ready for most people, and what was needed was a vehicle with a little more refinement. So in 1949, they released the 80-inch station wagon, essentially a short wheelbase Land Rover with a few extra refinements and an all-aluminium body over a wooden frame. But it was too expensive to produce and not many were sold, so Rover withdrew it from the market in 1951. But the Land Rover wasn't the one-hit wonder that Rover feared it would be, and the idea of a Land Rover that was good both on and off-road didn't go away. In 1951, Rover designer Gordon Bashford devised the Road Rover. An early concept looked like it was about to take Noddy off to Toy Town, but this was only a rough mock-up. It was to be based off a saloon car platform, not the Land Rover, to give it a premium car feel while offering limited off-roading. They would give the car long travel suspension to soak up the bumps, but it would be restricted in where it could go with only two-wheel drive. As Rover was spending most of its resources at the time creating the P4, which was Gordon's main job, the Road Rover became a side project and took many years to develop. It went through so many revisions that by 1956 it was known as the Road Rover Series 2. By 1958 it was being ready for production, but the project was cancelled. It's likely the complexity of the design and the continued success of the Land Rover were factors. Why spend money taking customers away from the Land Rover when projected sales of the Road Rover weren't high enough to justify it? So Rover went back to doing what it did best, producing P-Series saloons. Through the early 60s they focused on the P6 saloon and working on gas turbine engines for road-going cars. By 1964 the P6 was out the door and Rover was looking for ways to increase sales in the lucrative US market. The Road Rover idea had never really gone away, so the project was revived. Rover saw a growth in the recreational 4x4 vehicle market in the USA with cars such as the Jeep Wagoneer and the Ford Bronco, so they decided their new car would try to take some of that fast-growing market. The Range Rover is seen as such a luxury vehicle today that it's easy to think that it was designed that way from the outset. Although this was to be a more refined vehicle than the Land Rover, Rover's goal wasn't to make an upmarket vehicle. They wanted to make something that worked better on and off-road, but could still be a farmer's workhorse or the California surfer's recreational vehicle. The finished vehicle would be easy to wipe down with simple vinyl seats, rubber floor mats, and a plastic dashboard. Gordon Bashford was joined by Sven King to work on the car's engineering. It was soon determined that the car must have four-wheel drive to compete not only with the Ford and the Jeep, but also to outshine their own Land Rover, now nearly 20 years old. It was to have independent, long-travel suspension that was needed for going over rough terrain. The engine used would be the lightweight aluminium V8 that Rover had purchased from General Motors. It proved to be excellent for the job, providing the torque at low revs that 4x4s need. It was such a strong engine, it helped that the car had permanent four-wheel drive, so the power of the engine could be split between the front and rear axles. As the car was 99.9 inches in length, as a nod to the past, it became known during development as the 100-inch station wagon. The car needed to be simple to construct and hence cheap to manufacture, so it had a box steel structure with simple aluminium panels bolted onto it. David Bache, designer of the Rover P6, was brought in to design the shape and came up with some early designs, but he was beaten to the punch. Spen and Gordon had designed some simple panels to cover the car for testing, with some help from the styling department. When management saw the shape, they were so impressed they asked to keep the design, and for David Bache to only do small refinements to make it into the finished vehicle. Rover was subsumed into British Leyland in 1966, but it would take until early 1967 before BL's management got to see what Rover was working on. They liked the 100-inch station wagon so much it was immediately greenlit. By September, the first road-going prototype was finished and was put through its paces. It proved very good and only needed minor changes. David Bache spent 1967 finalising the design, and by early 68 it was signed off. The customer clinic reaction was good, and there was optimism that British Leyland had a hit vehicle on their hands. The next 2 years were spent performing final testing all over the world, in all conditions, and starting up the production line. The final car was launched to the press and public in June 1970 as the Range Rover, and it was an immediate hit, going on to win several awards. The French liked it so much they exhibited it as a piece of modern art at the Louvre. The car was something of a jack of all trades. It was an accomplished off-roader and a spacious estate car that didn't look like everyone else's estate car. People liked the commanding high seating position which made them feel more secure on the road. Soon it wasn't just farmers and outdoorsy types buying the car, but the upper middle class, and they weren't driving it off-road. Through the 1970s, the Range Rover was left almost untouched. British Leyland didn't have the cash to do much work on the vehicle, and they were focusing on winning the high-volume car sector. But the Range Rover was selling well, not only because it was a cracking vehicle, but also because it didn't have any competition. In fact, it's surprising how long it took other manufacturers to come up with something to compete with a Range Rover. BMW took until 1999 to bring us the X5, Audi brought us the Q7 in 2005, and when Mercedes first tried to compete with a Range Rover in 1990, they modified their utilitarian G-Wagon into this hideous creation. But by the end of the 70s, things were beginning to look up. Michael Edwards, the manager of British Leyland, decided that it made sense to move both a Land Rover and Range Rover into their own separate company. This allowed them to create their own destiny, funneling profits into further development. They started by testing the waters with new ideas. The Range Rover had always been a three-door, but the public wanted better access for rear passengers. Even though a five-door had been mocked up in 1972, to save money, Land Rover contracted out the design work and released it as a special edition in 1980. It was expensive, but proved that there was a market for a cheaper, full-production version. An automatic was also tested and proved popular, so full production five-door and automatic models were launched by 1982 with their cool-looking Morris Marina door handles. Another cheap but effective tactic was to offer special editions in new colours and all the luxury options. They chose to call these In Vogue versions with the cooperation of Vogue magazine, and this proved to be an effective tie-in to increase the cachet of the Range Rover brand. Through the 1980s, the car sold in greater and greater numbers, and tight control of finances meant big profits that could be ploughed back into the development of new models. Slowly, Land Rover Limited was transforming the Range Rover into a luxury SUV that the public demanded. Every year, the interior refinements made the car better and better, and the car was improved with a 5-speed gearbox and new diesel and petrol engines. In 1992, the 108-inch long wheelbase version was introduced, giving almost all of the extra room to rear passengers. The car was also upgraded to use air suspension, replacing the old-fashioned steel springs. This provided not only better handling, but also made it easier to get in and out of the car as the air suspension dropped to its lowest height when the car was stopped. In 1994, the Mark 1 Range Rover was replaced by the P38A second generation model. But that's another story for another day. The Range Rover can be seen as a happy accident. Spen King and Gordon Bashford's quick design job turned into a classic and highly functional shape. The engineering was so good that it didn't need work that it wouldn't have received in the lean years of the 1970s. And the car invented the luxury SUV market, a market they could capitalise on with only a little extra investment and without any competition. The original design lived on for an amazing 25 years. To quote Land Rover's own marketing quote, it truly was the best 4x4 by far. After talking about a couple of cars that have had their struggles, the Austin Metro and the Rover SD1, it's nice to talk about a car that ended up being a bit of a British success story. Maybe it was one of the survivors of the British Leyland period because it was designed and production started when BL could still put a car together with some competence, and after they produced it, BL had no money to change it, so pretty much left it alone. It's a similar story to the Jaguar XJ, I suppose, but that car really did wither on the vine. The Range Rover was lucky in that the market came to it. Rover took a punt on a luxury off-roader, a market that didn't exist in 1970, certainly in Europe. In the US, there was the Jeep Wagoneer in 1963 that had an automatic gearbox and wood grain siding because it was the 1960s. As the 1970s and 80s progressed, the luxury SUV market grew and the Range Rover pretty much had the market to itself. That was probably for the best. With such little investment in the car, competition might have buried it. But as we'll see in the next episode, the Range Rover would finally get the funding it deserved, but not without several bumps in the road. As always, if you like these podcasts, then tell your friends and any other random people you see in the street. If you want to see it along with many, many other car histories, take a look at my YouTube channel. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you in the next episode.